of time before someone thought to question folk coming into town. Best to play my part. Eventually, we began to see stretches of unworked land with sheep or harriger scattered across them in open pasturage. Shortly after noon, I did what I knew I had to do. I dismounted by a brushy creekside, let Arrow water again, and then turned his head back to Tradeford. "Back to the stables, boy," I told him. And when he did not move, I clapped him soundly on the flank. "Go on. Go back to Hans. Tell them all I'm dead somewhere." I pictured his manger for him, brimming with the oats I knew he loved. "Go on, Arrow. Go!" He snorted at me curiously, but then paced off. He paused once to look back at me, expecting me to come after him and catch him. "Go on!" I shouted at him and stamped my foot. He startled at that and then took off at his high-kneed trot, tossing his head, scarcely even tired, that one. When he came back riderless to the stable, perhaps they'd believe I was dead. Perhaps they'd waste more time searching for a body instead of pursuing me. It was the best I could do to mislead them, and certainly better than riding the king's own horse for all to see. Arrow's hoofbeats were fading. I wondered if I'd ever again ride an animal that fine, let alone own one. It didn't seem likely. "Come to me." The command still echoed through my mind. "I am. I am," I muttered to myself. "After I hunt for something to eat and get some sleep, but I'm coming." I left the road and followed the creek up into deeper brush. I had a long and weary way to go, with little more than the clothes on my back. 10. Hiring fair. Slavery is a tradition in the Chalced States, and is at the heart of much of its economy. They claim prisoners taken in war are the major source of its slaves. However, a great portion of the slaves who escaped to the Six Duchies tell tales of being taken in pirate raids against their native lands. Chalced's official stance is that such raids do not occur, but Chalced also officially denies that they turn a blind eye to pirates operating from the trade islands. The two go hand in hand. Slavery has never been commonly accepted in the Six Duchies. Many of the early border conflicts between Chokes and the Chalced States had more to do with the slavery issue than actual boundary lines. Chokes' families refused to accept that soldiers wounded or captured in war would be kept the rest of their lives as slaves. Any battle that Chokes lost was almost immediately followed by a second savage attack against the Chalced States to regain those lost in the first battle. In this way, Chokes came to hold much land originally claimed by the Chalced States. The peace between the two regions is always uneasy. Chalced constantly brings complaint that the folk of Chokes not only shelter runaway slaves, but encourage others to escape. No Six Duchies monarch has ever denied the truth of this. My whole drive now was to reach Verity, somewhere beyond the Mountain Kingdom. To do it, I would have to cross all of Farrow first. It would not be an easy task. While the region along the Vin River is pleasant enough, the farther one travels from the Vin, the more arid the countryside becomes. The arable stretches are given over to great fields of flax and hemp, but beyond these are vast stretches of open, uninhabited land. The interior of Farrow Duchy, while not a desert, is flat, dry country, used only by the nomadic tribes who move their herds across it, following the forage. Even they forsake it after the green times of the year are past, to congregate in temporary villages along rivers or near watering places. In the days that followed my escape from Tradeford Hall, I came to wonder why King Wielder had ever bothered to subjugate Farrow, let alone make it one of the Six Duchies. I knew that I had to strike away from the Vin, to head southwest toward Blue Lake, to cross Vast Blue Lake, and then follow the cold river to the hems of the mountains. Yet it was not a journey for a lone man, and without night eyes. That was what I was. There are no sizable cities in the interior, though there are rudimentary towns that subsist year-round near some of the springs that randomly dot the interior. Most of these survive by virtue of the trade caravans that pass near them. Trade does flow, albeit slowly, between the folk of Blue Lake and the Vin River, and by this same path do the goods of the mountain folk come into six duchies' hands. The obvious course was to somehow attach myself to one of those caravans. Yet what is obvious is not always easy. When I had entered trade for town, I had looked to be the poorest type of beggar imaginable. I left it finely dressed, on one of the best animals ever bred at Buckkeep. But the moments after I had parted with Arrow, the gravity of my situation began to dawn on me. I had the clothing I had stolen, and my leather boots, my belt and pouch, a knife and a sword, plus a ring, and a medallion on a chain. In my pouch there were no coins left at all, though it did contain implements for fire-making, a sharpening stone for my knife, and a good selection of poisons. Wolves are not meant to hunt alone, so Night Eyes had once told me, and before the day was out I came to appreciate the wisdom of that statement. My meal that day consisted of rice lily roots, and some nuts a squirrel had hoarded in too obvious a hiding place. I would gladly have eaten the squirrel, who sat overhead scolding at me as I raided his cache, but I had not the means to make that wish a reality. Instead, as I pounded the nuts with a stone to open them, I reflected that one by one, my illusions about myself had been stripped away. I had believed myself a self-sufficient and clever fellow. I had taken pride in my skills as an assassin, had even, deep down, believed that although I could not completely master my skill ability, my strength at it was easily the equal of any in Galen's coterie. But take away both King Shrewd's largesse and my wolf companion's hunting ability, subtract from me Chade's secret information and plotting skill, and Verity's skill guidance, and what I saw left was a starving man in stolen clothes, halfway between Buckkeep and the mountains, with small prospect of getting any closer to either one. Satisfyingly bleak as such thoughts were, they did nothing to assuage the nagging of Verity's skill suggestion. Come to me. Had he intended for those words to burn into my mind with such command? I doubted it. I think he had sought only to keep me from killing both Regal and myself, and yet now the compulsion was there, festering like an arrowhead. It even infected my sleep with anxiety, so that I dreamed often of going to Verity. It was not that I had given up my ambition of killing Regal. A dozen times a day I constructed plots in my mind, ways in which I might return to Tradeford and come at him from an unexpected angle. But all such plots began with the reservation, after I have gone to Verity. It had simply become unthinkable to me that there was anything else that had a higher priority. Several hungry days upriver of Tradeford is a town called Landing. While not nearly as large as Tradeford, it is a healthy settlement. Much good leather is made there, not just from cowhide, but from the rough pigskin of the Harriger herds as well. The other main industry of the town seemed to be a fine pottery, made from the banks of white clay that front the river. Much that one would expect to be made from wood or glass or metal elsewhere is made from leather or pottery in Landing. Not just shoes and gloves, but hats and other garments are of leather there, as are chair seats and even the roofs and walls of the stalls in the markets. In the shop windows, I saw trenchers and candlesticks and even buckets made of finely glazed pottery, all inscribed or painted in 100 styles and colors. I also found, eventually, a small bazaar where one might sell whatever one had to sell and not be asked too many questions. I traded away my fine clothes for the loose trousers and tunic of a workingman, plus one pair of stockings. I should have got a better trade, but the man pointed out several brownish stains on the cuffs of the shirt that he believed would not come out. And the leggings were stretched from fitting me so poorly. He could launder them, but he was not sure he could get them back into their proper shape. I gave it up and was content with the bargain I'd made. At least these clothes had not been worn by a murderer escaping from King Regal's mansion. In a shop farther down the street, I parted with the ring, the medallion, and the chain for 7 silver bits and 7 coppers. It was not near the passage fare to join a caravan to the mountains, but it was the best offer of the 6 I'd had. The chubby little woman who bought them from me reached out timidly to touch my sleeve as I turned away.
"I'd not ask this, sir, save I can see you're in a desperate way," she began hesitantly. "So, I pray you, take no offence at my offer."
"Which is?" I asked. I suspected she would offer to buy the sword. I had already decided I would not part with it. I would not get enough money for it to make it worth my while to go unarmed. She gestured shyly toward my ear.
"Your freeman's earring. I've a patron who collects such rarities. I believe that one is from the Boutran clan. Am I correct?"
She asked it so hesitantly, as if expecting that at any moment I might fly into a rage. "I do not know," I told her honestly. "It was a gift from a friend. It's not a thing I'd part with for silver." She smiled knowingly, suddenly more confident.
"Oh, I know we are speaking of golds for such a thing. I would not insult you with an offer of silvers."
"Golds?" I asked incredulously. I reached to touch the small bauble at my ear. "For this?"
"Of course,"
she assented easily, thinking I was feeling for a bid.
"I can see the workmanship is superior. Such is the reputation of the Boutran clan. There is also the rarity of it. The Boutran clan grants freedom to a slave, but rarely. Even this far from Chalced, that is known. Once a man or woman wears the Boutran tattoos, well..."
It took very little to draw her into a learned conversation about Chalced's slave trade and slave tattoos and freedom rings. It soon became apparent that she desired Burrich's earring not for any patron, but for herself. She'd had an ancestor who had won his way out of slavery. She still possessed the freedom ring he'd been granted by his owners as the visible sign that he was no longer a slave. The possession of such an earring, correctly matching the last clan symbol tattooed on a slave's cheek, was the only way a former slave might move freely in Chalced, let alone leave that country. If a slave was troublesome, it was easily seen from the number of tattoos across the face, tracking the history of ownership. So that map face was a byword for a slave that had been sold all over Chalced, a troublemaker fit for nothing but galley or mine work. She bade me take the earring off and truly look at it, at the fineness of the linked silver that made up the mesh that entrapped what was definitely a sapphire.
"You see," she explained, "a slave has not only to win himself free, but to then earn from his master the cost of such an earring, for without it, his freedom is little more than an extended leash. He can go nowhere without being stopped at the checkpoints, can accept no freeman's work without the written consent of his former owner. The former master is no longer liable for his food or shelter, but the former slave has no such freedom from his old owner."
She offered me 3 golds without hesitation. That was more than caravan fare. I could have bought a horse, a good horse, and not only joined a caravan but travelled in comfort on that. Instead, I left her shop before she would try to dissuade me with a higher offer. With a copper, I bought a loaf of coarse bread and sat down to eat it near the docks. I wondered a great many things. The earring had probably been Burrich's grandmother's. He had mentioned she had been a slave but had won free of that life. I wondered what the earring had come to mean to him, that he had given it to my father, and what it had meant to my father that he had kept it. Had Patience known any of this, when she had passed it on to me. I am human. I tempted myself with her offer of golds. I reflected that if Burrich knew of my situation, he would tell me to go ahead and sell it, that my life and safety were worth more to him than an earring of silver and sapphire. I could get a horse and go to the mountains and find Verity and put an end to the constant nagging of his skill order that was like an itch I could not scratch. I stared out over the river and finally confronted the enormous journey before me. From here, I must journey through near desert to get to Blue Lake. I had no idea how I would cross Blue Lake itself. On the other side, forest trails wound through the foothills up into the rugged lands of the Mountain Kingdom. To Jampe, the capital city, I must go, to somehow obtain a copy of the map Verity had used. It had been based on old writings in the Jampe Library. Perhaps the original was still there. Only it could lead me to Verity, somewhere in the unknown territory beyond the Mountain Kingdom. I would need every coin, every resource I could command. But despite all that, I decided to keep the earring. Not for what it meant to Burrich, but what it had come to mean to me. It was my last physical link to my past, to who I had been, to the man who had raised me, even to the father who had once worn it. It was oddly difficult to bring myself to do what I knew was wise. I reached up and undid the tiny catch that secured the earring to my ear. I still had the scraps of silk from my masquerade, and I used the smallest one to wrap the earring well and put it inside my belt pouch. The trader woman had been too interested in it and marked its appearance too well. If Regal did decide to send seekers after me, that earring would be one of the ways I'd be described. Afterward, I walked about the city, listening to folk talk and trying to learn what I needed to know without asking questions. I loitered in the marketplace, wandering from stall to stall, idly. I allotted myself the lavish sum of 4 coppers, and spent them on what seemed exotic luxuries: a small bag of tea herbs, dried fruit, a piece of looking-glass, a small cooking-pot, and a cup. I asked at several herb stalls for elf bark, but either they did not know it, or they knew it by another name in Faro. I told myself it was all right, for I did not expect to have any need for its restorative powers. I hoped I was right. Instead, I dubiously purchased something called sunskirt seeds, which I was assured would revive a man to wakefulness, no matter how weary he might be. I found a rag woman who let me go through her cart for 2 more coppers. I found a smelly but serviceable cloak and some leggings that promised to be as itchy as they were warm. I traded my remaining scraps of yellow silk for a head kerchief, and with many leering remarks, she showed me how to tie it about my head. I did as I had done before, making the cloak into a bundle to carry my things, and then went down to the slaughter yards, east of town. I had never encountered such a stench as I found there. There was pen after pen after pen of animals, veritable mountains of manure, the smell of blood and offal from the slaughter sheds and the harsh stinks of the tannery pits. As if the assault on my nose was not enough, the air was likewise filled with the bawling of cattle, the squealing of harrigers, the buzzing of the blowflies, and the shouts of the folk moving the animals from pen to pen, or dragging them off to slaughter. Steel myself as I would, I could not insulate myself from the blind misery and panic of the waiting animals. They had no clear knowledge of what awaited them, but the smell of the fresh blood and the cries of the other beasts awoke in some of them a terror equivalent to what I had felt as I sprawled on the dungeon floor. Yet here I must be, for this was where the caravans ended, and also where some began. Folk who had driven animals here to sell would most likely be returning. Most would be buying other trade goods to take back with them, so as not to waste a trip. I had hopes of finding some sort of work with one of them that would gain me the companionship of a caravan, at least as far as Blue Lake. I soon found that I was not the only one with such hopes. There was a ragtag hiring fair in a space between two taverns that fronted on the holding pens. Some of the folk there were herders who had come from Blue Lake with one herd, stayed in Landing to spend their earnings, and now, out of coin and far from home, were looking for passage back. For some of them, that was the pattern of their lives as drovers. There were a few youngsters there, obviously looking for adventure and travel, and a chance to strike out on their own. And there were those who were obviously the dregs of the town, folks who could get no steady work, or had not the character to live in one place for long. I did not blend very well with any group, but I ended up standing with the drovers. My tale was that my mother had recently died, and turned over her estates to my older sister, who had little use for me. And so, I had set out to travel to my uncle, who lived past Blue Lake, but my coin had run up before I had reached there. No, I'd not been a drover before, but we'd been wealthy enough to have horses, cattle, and sheep, and I knew the basic care of them, and, so some said, had a way with dumb beasts. I was not hired that day. Few were, and night found most of us bedding down right where we had stood all day. A baker's apprentice came amongst us with a tray of leftover wares, and I parted with another copper for a long loaf of dark bread studded with seeds. I shared it with a stout fellow, whose pale hair kept creeping out of his kerchief and over his face. In return, Crease offered me some dried meat, a drink of the most appalling wine I'd ever tasted, and a great deal of gossip. He was a talker, one of those men who take the most extreme stance on any topic, and have not conversations but arguments with their fellows. As I had little to say, Crease soon needled the other folk about us into a contentious discussion of the current politics in Farrow. Someone kindled a small fire, more for light than any need for warmth, and several bottles were passed about. I lay back, my head pillowed on my bundle, and pretended to be dozing as I listened. There was no mention of the red ships, no talk at all of the war that raged along the coast. I understood abruptly how much these folk would resent being taxed for troops to protect a coast they'd never even seen, for warships to sail an ocean they could not even imagine. The arid plains between Landing and Blue Lake were their ocean, and these drovers, the sailors who travelled on it. The six duchies were not by nature six regions of land bound into a whole, but were a kingdom only because a strong line of rulers had fenced them together with a common boundary and decreed them to be one. Should all of the coastal duchies fall to the red ships, it would mean little for these folk here. There would still be cattle to herd and loathsome wine to drink. There would still be grass, and the river and the dusty streets. Inevitably, I must wonder what right we had to force these folk to pay for a war so far from their homes. Tilth and Farrow had been conquered and added to the duchies. They had not come to us asking for military protection or the benefits of trade. Not that they hadn't prospered, freed of all their petty inland herd lords, and given an eager market for their beef and leather and rope. How much sailcloth, how many coils of good hemp rope had they sold before they were part of the six duchies? But it still seemed a minor return. I grew weary of such thoughts. The only constant to their conversation was complaint about the trade embargo with the mountains. I had begun to doze off when my ears pricked up to the words, "Pocked man." I opened my eyes and lifted my head slightly. Someone had mentioned him in the traditional way, as the harbinger of disaster, laughingly saying that Hensil's sheep had all seen him, for they were dying in their pen before the poor man could even sell them. I frowned to myself at the thought of disease in such close quarters, but another man laughed and said that King Regal had decreed it was no longer bad luck to see the pocked man, but the greatest good that could befall one.
"If I saw that old beggar, I'd not blanch and flee, but tackle him and take him to the king himself. He's offered 100 golds to any man can bring him the pocked man from Buck." was 50. Only 50 golds, not 100.
Creese interrupted jeeringly. He took another drink from his bottle.
What a story! 100 golds for a grey old man!
No, it's 100 for him alone, and another 100 for the man-wolf that dogs his heels. The herd had cried anew just this afternoon. They crept into the king's mansion at Tradeford and slew some of his guard with beast magic, throats torn right out that the wolf might drink the blood. He's the one they want bad now. Dresses like a gentleman, they said, with a ring and a necklace and a silver dangle at his ear. Streak of white in his hair, from an old battle with our king, and a scar down his face, and a broken nose from the same.
Yes, and a nice new sword slash up his arm is what the king give him this time.
There was a low mutter of admiration from several of them at this. Even I had to admire Regal's audacity at claiming that, even as I turned my face back into my bundle and burrowed down as if to sleep. The gossip continued.
Supposed to be Whitbread he is, and able to turn himself into a wolf whenever the moon is on him. They sleep by day and prowl by night, they do. It's said it's a curse put on the king by the foreigner queen he chased out of Buck for trying to steal the crown. The pocked man, it's told, is a half-spirit, charmed from the body of old King Shrewd by her mountain magic, and he travels all the roads and streets anywhere in the six duchies, bringing ill wherever he goes, and wearing the face of the old king himself.
"Dung and rot!"
Creese said disgustedly. He took another swig himself, but some of the others liked this wild tale and leaned closer, whispering for him to go on, go on.
"That's what I heard,"
the storyteller said huffily.
"That the pocked man is Shrewd's half-spirit, and he can't know any rest until the Mountain Queen that poisoned him is in her grave as well. So, if the pocked man is Shrewd's ghost, why is King Regal offering 100 golds reward for him?"
Creese asked sourly.
"Not his ghost, his half-spirit. He stole part of the king's spirit as he was dying, and King Shrewd can know no rest until the pocked man is dead, so the king's spirit can be rejoined. And some say—"
And he dropped his voice lower.
"That the bastard was not killed well enough, that he walks again as a man-wolf. He and the pocked man seek vengeance against King Regal to destroy the throne he could not steal, for he was in league to be king to the vixen queen once they'd done away with Shrewd."
It was the right sort of night for such a tale. The moon was swollen and orange and riding low in the sky, while the wind brought us the mournful lowing and shifting of the cattle in their pens, mixed with the stench of rotting blood and tanning hides. High tattered clouds drifted from time to time across the face of the moon. The storyteller's words put a shiver up my back, probably for a different reason than he thought. I kept waiting for someone to nudge me with a foot or cry out,
"Hey, let's have a better look at him!"
No one did. The tone of the man's tale had them looking for wolf-eyes in the shadows, not for a weary workman sleeping in their midst. Nonetheless, my heart was thudding in my chest as I looked back down my trail. The tailor, where I'd traded clothes, would recognize that description. Possibly the earring woman, even the old rag woman who had helped me tie the kerchief over my hair. Some might not want to come forward. Some might want to avoid dealing with the king's guards. Some would, though. I should behave as if they all would. The speaker was going on, embroidering his tale of Ketrickin's evil ambitions, and how she had lain with me to conceive a child we could use to claim the throne. There was loathing in the storyteller's voice as he spoke of Ketrickin, and no one scoffed at his words. Even Creese at my side was acquiescent, as if these bizarre plots were common knowledge. Confirming my worst fears, Creese spoke up suddenly.
"You tell it like it's all new."
But all knew her big belly came not from Verity, but from the wit bastard.
Had Regal not driven off the mountain whore, we would eventually have had one like the piebald prince in line for the throne.
There was a low murmur of assent to this. I closed my eyes and lay back as if bored, hoping that my stillness and lowered lids could conceal the rage that threatened to consume me. I reached up to tug my kerchief more snugly about my hair. What could be Regal's purpose in letting such evil gossip be noised about? For I knew this kind of poison would come from him. I did not trust my voice to ask any questions, nor did I wish to appear ignorant of what was evidently common knowledge. So I lay still and listened with savage interest. I gathered that all knew Kettricken had returned to the mountains. The freshness of the contempt they had for her suggested to me that this was recent news. There was muttering, too, that it was the fault of the mountain witch that the passes were closed to honest tilth and farrow traders. One man even ventured to say that now that trade with the coast was shut down, the mountains saw a chance to fence farrow and tilth in and force them to come to terms or lose all trade routes. One man recounted that even a simple caravan escorted by 6 Dutchies men in Regal's own colours had been turned back from the mountain border. To me, such talk was obviously stupid. The mountains needed the trade with farrow and tilth. Grain was more important to the mountain folk than the lumber and furs of the mountains to these lowlanders. Such free trade had been openly admitted as a reason for wedding Kettricken to Verity. Even if Kettricken had fled back to the mountains, I knew her well enough to be sure she would not support any cutting off of trade between her folk and the 6 Dutchies. She was too bonded to both groups, so intent on being sacrifice for all of them. If there were a trade embargo, as I had heard, I was sure it had begun with Regal. But the men about me grumbled on about the mountain witch and her vendetta against the king. Was Regal fomenting a war with the mountains? Had he been attempting to send armed troops there under the guise of escorts for traders? It was a foolish idea. Long ago my father had been sent to the mountains to formalize boundaries and trade agreements with them, marking the end of long years of border skirmishes and raids. Those years of battle had taught King Shrewd that no one was going to take and hold the mountain kingdom passes and trails by force. Unwillingly, I followed that thought. Regal had been the one to suggest Kettricken as a bride for Verity. He had done all the courtier's work of wooing her for his brother. Then, as the time for the wedding drew near, he had attempted to kill Verity with the aim of securing the princess as his own bride. He had failed, and his plots and plans had been revealed to only a few. The chance for him to claim Princess Kettricken as his own, and all that went with her, such as her eventual inheritance of the mountain crown, had slipped through his fingers. I recalled some talk I had once heard between Regal and the traitorous Galen. They had seemed to think that Tilth and Farrow would be best secured if they could control the mountain ranges and passes that backed them. Did Regal now think to take by force what he had once hoped to claim by marriage? Did he think he could rally enough ill will against Kettricken to make his followers believe they were waging a just war, one of vengeance against a mountain witch, one to keep open key trade routes? Regal, I reflected, was capable of believing anything he wished to believe. In the depths of his cups, head wreathed with his smokes, I did not doubt that he now believed his own wild tales. 100 golds for Chade, and another 100 for me. I knew well enough what I had done lately to merit such a head price, but I wondered keenly just what Chade had been up to. In all my years with Chade, he had always worked unnamed and unseen. He still had no name, but his pocked skin and resemblance to his half-brother were known now. That meant he had been seen somewhere by someone. I hoped he was well and safe this night, wherever he was. A part of me yearned to turn back, to return to Buck, and track him down, as if somehow I could keep him safe. Come to me. No matter what I longed to do, no matter what I felt, I knew that first I would go to Verity. I promised myself that over and over, and was finally able to drop off into a weary doze. I dreamed, but they were pale dreams, barely touched by the skill, shifting and turning, as if blown by the autumn winds. My mind seemed to have caught up and jumbled together thoughts of every person I missed. I dreamed of Chade taking tea with Patience and Lacey. He wore a robe of red silk, patterned over with stars, cut in a very odd style, and he smiled charmingly at the women over his cup and brought laughter even to Patience's eyes, although she looked strangely worn and weary. I then dreamed of Molly peeping out of a cottage door while Burridge stood outside it, pulling his cloak tight against the wind and telling her not to worry. He'd not be gone that long, and any heavy chores could keep until he returned, that she should stay within doors and have only a care for herself. Even of Celerity did I dream, that she had taken shelter in the fabled ice caves of the Hungry Glacier in Bairns, and hid there with what troops she could still rally, and many of her folk made homeless by the raider wars. I dreamed she tended Faith, who lay suffering with a fever and a festering arrow wound in her belly. I dreamed finally of the fool, his white face turned to ivory as he sat before a hearth and stared into the flames. There was no hope left in his face, and I felt that I was within the flames, looking deeply into his eyes. Somewhere nearby, and yet not very near, Ketrickin was weeping inconsolably. My dreams withered in my mind, and then I dreamed of wolves hunting, running down a buck. But they were wild wolves, and if my wolf was among them, he was theirs, and mine no longer. I awoke with a headache and a crick in my back from a stone I'd slept on. The sun had only begun to crack the sky, but I rose anyway, to go to a well and draw water for washing, and to drink as much as I could hold. Burridge had once told me that drinking a lot of water was a good way to stave off hunger. It was a theory I'd have to test today. I put an edge on my knife, considered shaving, then decided against it. Better to let my beard grow over the scar as swiftly as possible. I rubbed reluctantly at the coarse growth that already irritated me. I went back to where the others still slept. They were just beginning to stir when a bulky little man appeared to call shrilly that he would hire a man to help move his sheep from one pen to another. It was only a morning's work, if that, and most of the men shook their heads, wishing to remain where they might be hired for a drover's trip to Blue Lake. He almost pleaded, saying he must move the sheep through the city streets, hence he needed to get it done before the day's common traffic began. Finally, he offered to include breakfast, and I really think that was why I nodded to him and followed him. His name was Damon, and he talked the whole time we walked, fluttering his hands about, explaining needlessly to me just how he wanted these sheep handled. They were good stock, very good stock, and he didn't want them injured or even flustered. Calmly, slowly, that was the best way to move sheep. I nodded wordlessly to his worrying and followed him to a pen far down the slaughter street. It soon became apparent why he was so anxious to move his sheep. The next pen must have belonged to the luckless Hensil. A few sheep still barred in that pen, but most of them were down, dead, or dying of flux. The stench of their sickness added a new foul note to the other smells in the air. Some men were there taking the skins off the dead animals to salvage what they could from the flock. They were making bloody, messy work of it, leaving the skinned, dead animals right there in the pen with the dying ones. It reminded me in some gruesome way of a battlefield, with looters moving among the fallen. I turned my eyes from the sight and helped Damon bunch up his sheep. Trying to use the wit on sheep is almost a waste of time. They are flighty of thought. Even those ones who appear most placid are so because they have forgotten what they were thinking about. The worst of them are capable of an inordinate amount of wariness, becoming suspicious of the simplest act. The only way to deal with them is much as herd dogs do. Convince them they have had a good idea about where they wish to go, and encourage them in it. I amused myself briefly by considering how Night-Eyes would have bunched up and moved these woolly fools. But my even thinking of a wolf caused a few of them to halt in their tracks suddenly and glance about wildly. I suggested to them they should follow the others before they were lost, and they started as if surprised at the notion, then crowded in amongst the rest of the sheep. Damon had given me a general idea of where we were going, and a long stick. I worked the back and sides of the flock, running and soon panting like a dog, while he led the way and kept the flock from scattering at every intersection. He took us to an area on the outskirts of town, and we put the sheep into one of the ramshackle pens there. Another pen held a very fine red bull, while there were six horses in yet another. After we had caught our breath, he explained that tomorrow a caravan would be forming up here to travel to Blue Lake. He had bought these sheep just yesterday, and intended to take them to his home there to add to his flocks. I asked him if he might want another hand to herd the sheep to Blue Lake, and he gave me a considering look. But no answer. He was as good as his word about breakfast. We had porridge and milk, plain fare that tasted wonderfully good to me. It was served to us by a woman who lived in a house near the holding pens, and made her living keeping watch over the animals penned there, and providing meals, and sometimes beds, for those in charge of them. After we had eaten, Damon laboriously explained to me that, yes, he was in need of an extra hand, possibly two, for the trip, but that he judged by the cut of my clothes that I knew little of the type of work I was seeking. He'd taken me on this morning because I was the only one who looked really awake and eager for the work. I told him my story of my heartless sister, and assured him that I was familiar with handling sheep, horses, or cattle. After much dithering and druthering, he hired me. His terms were that he would provide my food for the journey, and at the end of it, would pay me 10 silver bits. He told me to run and fetch my things and say my goodbyes, but to be certain to be back here by the evening, or he would hire another to take my place. "I have nothing to fetch, and no one to bid good-bye to," I told him. It would not be wise to go back to town, not after what I'd heard last night. I wished the caravan were leaving right now. For an instant he looked shocked, but then decided he was well pleased. "Well, I have both to attend to, so I shall leave you here to watch over the sheep. They'll need water hauled to them. That was one reason I was leaving them in the town pens. They've a pump there. But I didn't like to have them so near sick sheep. You haul them water, and I'll send a man out with a cart for hay for them. See you give them a good feed. Now, mind, I'll judge how we are to go on together by how you begin with me." And so on he went, telling me to the last detail how he wished the animals watered, and how many separate piles of feed to make, to be sure each animal got a share. I suppose it was to be expected. I did not look like a shepherd. It made me miss Burridge, and his calm assumption that I would know my business and do it. As he was turning to go, he suddenly turned back.
"And your name, lad?"
he called to me.
"Tom,"
I said, after an instant's hesitation. Patience had thought once to call me that, before I had accepted the name Fitzchivalry. The reflection called to mind something Regal had once flung at me.
"You'll have to but scratch yourself to find Nameless, the dog boy,"
he'd sneered. I doubted he would think Tom the Shepherd much above that. There was a dug well not very near the pens, with a very long rope to its bucket. By working constantly, I finally managed to get the water trough filled. Actually, I filled it several times before the sheep allowed it to remain filled. And then, a cart with hay arrived, and I carefully created 4 separate piles of feed in the corners of the pen. It was another exercise in frustration, as the sheep bunched and fed off each pile as I created it. It was only after all but the weakest were satiated that I could finally establish a pile in each corner. I whiled away the afternoon with drawing more water. The woman gave me the use of a large kettle to heat it, and a private place where I could wash the worst of the road from my body. My arm was healing well, not bad for a deadly injury, I told myself, and hoped Chade would never hear of my blundering. How he would laugh at me! When I was clean, I fetched more water to heat, this for washing out the clothes I bought from the rag woman. I discovered the cloak was actually a much lighter grey than I had thought it. I could not get all the smell out of it, but by the time I hung it to dry, it smelled more of wet wool and less of its previous owner. Damon had left me no provision for food, but the woman offered to feed me if I would haul the water for the bull and the horses, as it was a chore she'd grown much weary of doing for the last 4 days. So I did, and earned myself a dinner of stew and biscuits, and a mug of ale to wash it all down. Afterward, I checked on my sheep, finding them all placid. Habit made me turn to the bull and the horses. I stood leaning on the fence, watching the animals, wondering how it would be if this were all there was to my life. It made me realize that it would not have been bad. Not if there'd been a woman like Molly waiting for me to come home at night. A rangy white mare came over to rub her nose up my shirt and beg to be scratched. I petted her and found her missing a freckled farm girl who had brought her carrots and called her Princess. I wondered if anyone anywhere got to live the life he'd wanted. Perhaps Night Eyes finally had. I truly hoped so. I wished him well, but was selfish enough to hope that sometimes he'd miss me. Sullenly, I wondered if perhaps that was why Verity had not come back. Maybe he'd just got sick of the whole business of crowns and thrones, and kicked over all his traces. But even as I thought it, I knew it was not so. Not that one. He'd gone to the mountains to rally the elderlings to our aid, and if he'd failed at that task, then he'd think of another way. And whatever it was, he'd called me to help him do it. 11. Shepherd. Chade Falstar, advisor to King Shrewd, was a loyal servant of the Farseer throne. Few knew of his services during the years he served King Shrewd. This did not displease him, for he was not a man who sought glory. Rather, he was devoted to the Farseer reign with a loyalty that surpassed his loyalty to himself, or any other consideration most men have. He took most seriously his vow to the royal family. With the passing of King Shrewd, he pursued his vow to see that the crown followed the true line of succession. For this reason alone, he was sought after as an outlaw, for he openly challenged Regal's claim to be king of the 6 duchies. In missives he sent to each of the dukes, as well as to Prince Regal, he revealed himself after years of silence, declaring himself as a loyal follower of King Verity, and vowing he would follow no other until he was shown proof of the king's death. Prince Regal declared him a rebel and a traitor, and offered reward for his capture and death. Chade Falstar evaded him by many clever artifices, and continued to rally the coastal dukes to the belief that their king was not dead, and would return to lead them to victory over the red ships. Bereft of any hope of aid from King Regal, many of the lesser nobles clung to these rumours. Songs began to be sung, and even the common folk spoke with hope that their skilled king would return to save them, with the legendary elderlings riding at his back. By late afternoon, folk began to gather for the caravan. One woman owned the bull and horses. She and her husband arrived in a wagon drawn by a brace of oxen. They built their own fire, cooked their own food, and seemed content with their own company. My new master returned later, a bit tipsy, and goggled at the sheep to be sure I'd fed and watered them. He arrived in a high-wheeled cart drawn by a sturdy pony, one he immediately entrusted to my care. He'd hired another man, he told me, one Crease. I should watch for him to come and show him where the sheep were. He then disappeared into a room to sleep. I sighed to myself to think of a long journey with Crease's tongue and abrasive way to speed it, but did not complain. Instead, I busied myself caring for the pony, a willing little mare named Drum. Next to arrive was company of a merrier sort. They were a troop of puppeteers with a gaily painted wagon drawn by a team of dappled horses. There was a window in one side of the wagon that could be let down for puppet shows, and an awning that could be unrolled from the side to roof a stage where they were using the larger marionettes. The master puppeteer was named Dell. He had three apprentices and one journey puppeteer, as well as a minstrel who had joined them for the trip. They did not make their own fire, but proceeded to liven up the woman's little house with song and the clacking of marionettes and a number of mugs of ale. Two teamsters came next, with two wagons full of carefully packed crockery, and then finally the caravan master and her four helpers. These were the ones who would do more than guide us. The very look of their leader inspired confidence. Madge was a stoutly built woman, her slate-grey hair constrained from her face by a band of beaded leather. Two of her helps seemed to be a daughter and a son. They knew the waterholes, clean and foul, would defend us from bandits, carried extra food and water, and had agreements with nomads whose pasturing territory we'd be passing through. That last was as important as any of the rest, for the nomads did not welcome folk who passed through their lands with grazing animals to eat the feed their own flocks needed. Madge called us together that evening to inform us of this, and to remind us that they would keep order within our group as well. No theft or troublemaking would be tolerated. The pace set would be one all could sustain. The caravan master would handle all dealings at the watering places and with the nomads, and all must agree to abide by the decisions of the caravan master as law. I murmured my assent along with the others. Madge and her help then checked the wagons to be sure each was fit for travel, that the teams were sound, and that there were adequate water and food supplies for emergencies. We would travel a zigzag course from watering place to watering place. Madge's wagon carried several oak casks for water, but she insisted every private wagon and team carry some for their own needs. Crease arrived with the setting of the sun, after Damon had already gone back to his room and bed. I dutifully showed him the sheep and then listened to his grumbling that Damon had not provided us with a room to sleep in. It was a clear, warm night, with only a bit of wind, so I saw little to complain about. I did not say so, but let him mutter and complain until he was weary of it. I slept just outside the sheep pen, on guard lest any predators come near. But Crease wandered off to annoy the puppeteers with his dour nature and extensive opinions. I don't know how long I truly slept. My dreams parted like curtains blown by a wind. I came alert to a voice whispering my name. It seemed to come from far away, but as I listened, I was compelled inexorably to it, as if summoned by a charm. Like an errant moth, I became aware of candle flames and was drawn toward them. Four candles burned brightly on a rough wooden table, and their mingling scents sweetened the air. The two tall tapers gave off the scent of bayberry. Two smaller ones burned before them, giving off a sweet spring scent. Violets, I thought, and something else. A woman leaned forward over them, breathing deeply of the rising perfume. Her eyes were closed, her face misted with sweat. Molly. She spoke my name again. Fitz. Fitz. How could you die and leave me like this? It wasn't supposed to be this way. You were supposed to come after me. You were supposed to find me so I could forgive you. You should have lit these candles for me. I wasn't supposed to be alone for this.
The words were interrupted by a great gasp, as of a wrenching pain, and with a wave of fear frantically fought down.
"It's going to be all right," Molly whispered to herself. "It's going to be all right. It's supposed to be like this, I think."
Even within the skill dream, my heart stood still. I looked down at Molly as she stood near the hearth in a small hut. Outside, an autumn storm was raging. She grasped the edge of a table and half crouched, half leaned over it.
She wore only a nightrobe, and her hair was slick with sweat. As I watched, aghast, she took another great gulping breath and then cried out, not a scream, but a thin caw the sound, as if that were all she had strength for. After a minute she straightened a bit and put her hand softly on the top of her belly. I felt dizzied at the size of it. It was so distended she looked pregnant. She was pregnant. If it were possible to lose consciousness when one is asleep, I think I would have done so. Instead, my mind reeled suddenly, reordering every word she had said to me when we had parted, recalling the day when she had asked me what I would do if she had been carrying my child. The baby was the one she had spoken of, the one she had left me for, the one she would put ahead of every other in her life, not another man. Our child. She'd left to protect our child. And she hadn't told me because she was afraid I wouldn't go with her. Better not to ask than to ask and be refused. And she had been right. I wouldn't have gone. There had been too much happening at Buckkeep, too pressing the duties to my king. She'd been right to abandon me. It was so like Molly to make the leaving and the facing this alone her own choice, stupid. But so like her I wanted to hug her. I wanted to shake her. She clutched the table again suddenly, her eyes going wide, voiceless now with the force that moved through her. She was alone. She believed I was dead. And she was having the child alone in that tiny, wind-swept hut. Somewhere. I reached for her, crying, "Molly! Molly!" But she was focused inward on herself now, listening only to her own body. I suddenly knew Verity's frustration, those times when he could not make me hear him, and most desperately needed to reach me. The door gusted open suddenly, admitting blowing storm wind into the hut, and a blast of cold rain with it. She lifted her eyes, panting, to stare at it. "Burridge!" she called breathlessly. Her voice was full of hope. Again I felt a wave of astonishment, but it was drowned by her gratitude and relief when his dark face peered suddenly around the door frame. "It's only me, soaked through. I couldn't get you any dried apples, no matter what I offered. The town stores are bare. I hope the flour didn't get wet. I'd have been back sooner, but this storm..." He was coming in as he spoke, a man coming home from town, a carry sack over his shoulder. Water streamed down his face and dripped from his cloak.
"It's time. It's now,"
Molly told him frantically. Burridge dropped his sack as he dragged the door shut and latched it.
"What?"
he asked her, as he wiped rain from his eyes and pushed the wet hair back from his face.
"The baby's coming."
She sounded oddly calm now. He looked at her blankly for an instant. Then he spoke firmly.
"No. We counted. You counted. It can't be coming now."
Abruptly he sounded almost angry. He was so desperate to be right.
"Another 15 days, maybe longer. The midwife, I talked to her today and arranged everything. She said she'd come to see you in a few days."
His words died away as Molly gripped the table's edge. Her lips drew back from her teeth as she strained. Burridge stood like a man transfixed. He went as pale as I'd ever seen him.
"Shall I go back to the village and get her?"
he asked in a small voice. There was the sound of water pattering on the rough floorboards. After an eternity, Molly caught a breath.
"I don't think there's time."
Still he stood as if frozen, his cloak dripping water onto the floor. He came no farther into the room, stood still as if she were an unpredictable animal.
"Shouldn't you be lying down?"
he asked uncertainly.
"I tried that. It really hurts if I'm lying down, and a pain comes. It made me scream."
He was nodding like a puppet.
"Then you should stand up, I suppose, of course."
He didn't move. She looked up at him pleadingly.
"It can't be that different," she panted, "from a foal or a calf."
His eyes went so wide I could see the whites all around them. He shook his head fiercely, mutely.
"But, Burridge, there's no one else to help me, and I'm..."
Her words were suddenly torn away from her in a sort of cry. She leaned forward on the table, her legs folding so her forehead rested on the edge of it. She made a low sound, full of fear as well as pain. Her fear broke through to him. He gave his head a tiny, quick shake, a man awakening.
"No, you're right. It can't be that different, can't be. I've done this hundreds of times. Just the same, I'm sure of it, all right? Now let's see. I'm going to be all right. Let me just,
He tore off his cloak and let it drop to the floor. He hastily pushed his wet hair back from his face, then came to kneel beside her.
"I'm going to touch you,"
he warned her, and I saw her bowed head give a small bob of agreement. Then his sure hands were on her belly, stroking down gently but firmly, as I'd seen him do when a mare was having a bad time, and he wished to hasten things for her.
"Not long now. Not much more," he told her. "It's really dropped."
He was suddenly confident, and I felt Molly take heart from his tone. He kept his hands on her as another contraction took her.
"That's good, that's right."
I'd heard him say those same comforting words 100 times in the stalls of Buck Keep. Between pains, he steadied her with his hands, talking all the while softly, calling her his good girl, his steady girl, his fine girl that was going to drop a fine baby. I doubt either of them heard the sense of what he said. It was all the tone of his voice. He rose once to get a blanket and folded it on the floor beside him. He said no awkward words as he lifted Molly's nightdress out of the way, but only spoke softly, encouragingly, as Molly clenched the table's edge. I could see the ripple of muscle, and then she cried out suddenly, and Burridge was saying, "Keep going, keep going, here we are, keep going, that's fine. And what do we have here? Who's this?" Then the child was in his grasp, head in one cupped, calloused hand, his other supporting the tiny, curled body, and Burridge sat down suddenly on the floor, looking as amazed as if he had never seen anything born before. The women's talk I had overheard had made me expect hours of screaming and pools of blood. But there was little blood on the babe that looked up at Burridge with calm, blue eyes. The greyish cord coiling from the belly looked large and thick compared to the tiny hands and feet. All was silence, save for Molly's panting. Then,
"Is he all right?"
Molly demanded. Her voice shook.
"Is something wrong? Why doesn't he cry?"
"She's fine,"
Burridge said softly.
"She's fine. And as beautiful as she is, what would she have to cry about?"
He was silent for a long time, a man transfixed. Finally, he reluctantly set her gently aside on the blanket, turned a corner of it up to cover her.
"You've a bit more work to do here, girl, before we're done,"
he told Molly gruffly. But it was not long before he had Molly seated in a chair by the fire, a blanket about her to keep her from taking a chill. He hesitated a moment, then cut the cord with his belt knife, before wrapping the child in a clean cloth and taking her to Molly. Molly immediately unwrapped her. While Burridge was tidying the room, Molly examined every inch of her, exclaiming over her sleek black hair, the tiny fingers and toes with their perfect nails, the delicacy of her ears. Then Burridge did the same, while he held the baby and turned his back, so that Molly might change into a nightgown that wasn't soaked through with sweat. He studied her with an intentness I'd never seen him give to a foal or a pup.
"You're going to have chivalry's brow,"
he told the babe softly, He smiled at her and touched her cheek with one finger. She turned her head toward the touch. When Molly came back to her seat by the fire, he handed the child back to her, but crouched on the floor beside her chair as Molly put the babe to her breast. It took the baby a few tries to find and hold the nipple, but when she finally suckled, Burridge heaved such a sigh that I knew he had been holding his breath for fear she would not nurse. Molly had eyes only for the child, but I marked how Burridge lifted his hands to rub at his face and eyes, and that those hands trembled. He smiled as I had never seen him do before. Molly lifted her gaze to him, her face like a sunrise. "Would you make me a cup of tea, please?" she softly asked him, and Burridge nodded, grinning like a simpleton. I came out of my dream hours before dawn, not knowing at first when I passed from thoughtfulness to wakefulness. I became aware my eyes were open, and I was staring at the moon. It would be impossible to describe my feelings at that time. But slowly my thoughts took shape, and I understood the previous skill dreams I'd had of Burridge. It explained much. I'd been seeing him through Molly's eyes. He'd been there all this time with Molly, taking care of her. She was the friend he'd gone to help, the woman who could use a man's strength for a bit. He'd been there with her, while I had been alone. I felt a sudden rising of anger that he had not come to me and told me that she carried my child. It was quickly quenched as I suddenly realized that perhaps he'd tried. Something had brought him back to the cabin that day. I wondered again what he had thought when he'd found it abandoned, that all of his worst fears for me had come true, that I'd gone feral, never to return. But I would return, like a door swinging open. I suddenly understood that I could do that. Nothing truly stood between Molly and me. There was no other man in her life, only our child. I grinned suddenly to myself. I would not let so small a thing as my death come between us. What was death compared to a child's life shared? I would go to her and explain. I'd tell her everything this time, and this time she would understand, and she'd forgive me, because there would never be any other secrets between us. I didn't hesitate. I sat up in the darkness, picked up my bundle that I'd been using as a pillow, and set out. Downriver was so much easier than up. I had a few silvers. I'd get onto a boat somehow, and when they ran out, I'd work my passage. The Vin was a slow river, but once I was past Ter Lake, the Buck River would rush me along in its strong current. I was going back home, to Molly and our daughter. "Come to me." I halted. It was not Verity's skilling to me, I knew that. This came from within me, the mark left by that sudden and powerful skilling. I was certain that if he knew why I had to go home, he'd tell me to hurry, not to worry about him, that he'd be fine. It would be all right. All I had to do was keep walking. One step after another down a moonlit road. With each footfall, with each beat of my heart, I heard words in my mind, "Come to me, come to me." "I can't," I pleaded. "I won't," I defied them. I kept walking. I tried to think only of Molly, only of my tiny daughter. She would need a name. Would Molly have named her before I got there? "Come to me." "We'd need to get married right away, find some local witnesser in some small village. Burridge would vouch that I was a foundling with no parentage for the witnesser to memorize. I'd say my name was Newboy. An odd name, but I'd heard odder. And I could live with it the rest of my life. Names, once so important to me, no longer mattered. They could call me Horse Dung, as long as I could live with Molly and my daughter. "Come to me." I'd need to get work of some kind, any kind. I abruptly decided that the silvers in my pouch were far too important to spend, that I'd have to work for my entire passage home, And once I was there, what could I do to earn a living? What was I fit for? I pushed the thought aside angrily. I'd find something, I'd find a way. I'd be a good husband, a good father. They would want for nothing.
Come to me.
My steps had gradually slowed. Now I stood upon a small rise, looking down the road before me. Lights still burned in the river town below. I had to go down there and find a barge heading downriver, willing to take on an unproven hand. That was all. Just keep moving. I did not then understand why I could not. I took a step. I stumbled. The world swung around me dizzily, and I went to my knees. I could not go back. I had to go on. To Verity. I still do not understand it, so I cannot explain it. I knelt on the rise, looking down at the town, knowing clearly what I wished with all my heart to do. And I could not do it. Nothing held me back. No man lifted a hand or sword to me, and bid me turn aside. Only the small, insistent voice in my mind, battering at me, "Come to me, come to me, come to me." And I could not do otherwise. I could not tell my heart to stop beating. I could not cease breathing and die. And I could not ignore that summoning. I stood alone in the night, trapped and suffocating in another man's will for me. A cool-headed portion of myself said, "There, well, you see, that is how it is for them. For Will and the rest of the coterie, skill imprinted by Galen, to be loyal to Regal. It did not make them forget they had had another king. It did not make them believe what they did was right. They simply had no choice about it any more. And to take it back a generation. That was how it had been for Galen, forced to be so frantically loyal to my father. Verity had told me that his loyalty was a skill imprinting, done by chivalry when they were all little more than boys. Done in anger against some cruelty, Galen had wrought against Verity. The act of an older brother taking revenge on someone who had been mean to his little brother. It had been done to Galen in anger and ignorance, not even knowing fully that such a thing was possible. Verity said chivalry had regretted it, would have undone it if he had known how. Had Galen ever awakened to what had been done to him? Did that account for his fanatical hatred of me? Had it been a passing down to the son of the anger he could not allow himself to feel towards chivalry? My father? I tried to get to my feet, and failed. I sank slowly to the dirt in the center of the moonlit road, then sat there, hopelessly. It didn't matter. None of it mattered, save that there were my lady and my child, and I could not get to them. Could no more go to them than I could climb the night sky and take down the moon. I gazed afar to the river, shining blackly in the moonlight, rippled like black slate, a river that could carry me home but would not, because the fierceness of my will was still not enough to break past that command in my mind. I looked up to the moon.
"Burich,"
I pleaded aloud as if he could hear me. "Oh, take care of them. See they come to no harm. Guard them as if they were your own. Until I can come to them." I do not recall going back to the holding pens, or lying down to sleep. But morning came, and when I opened my eyes, that was where I was. I lay looking up at the blue arc of the sky, hating my life. Kreese came to stand between me and the heavens, and looked down on me.
"You'd better get up," he told me,
and then, peering closer, he observed,
"Your eyes are red. You got a bottle you didn't share?"
"I've got nothing to share with anybody," I told him succinctly. I rolled to my feet. My head was pounding. I wondered what Molly would name her. A flower name, probably. Lilac, or something like that. Rose, marigold. What would I have named her? It didn't matter. I stopped thinking. For the next few days I did what I was told. I did it well and thoroughly, distracted by no thoughts of my own. Somewhere inside me, a madman raged in his cell, but I chose not to know of that. Instead, I herded sheep. I ate in the morning, I ate in the evening. I lay down at night and I rose in the morning, and I herded sheep. I followed them, in the dust of the wagons and the horses, and the sheep themselves, the dust that clotted thick on my eyelashes and skin, dust that coated my throat with dryness, and I thought of nothing. I did not need to think, to know that every step carried me closer to Verity. I spoke so little that even Kreis wearied of my company, for he could not provoke me to argument. I herded the sheep as single-mindedly as the best sheepdog that ever lived, when I lay down to sleep at night. I did not even dream. Life went on for the rest of them. The caravan master guided us well, and the trip was blessedly uneventful. Our misfortunes were limited to dust, little water, and sparse grazing, and those misfortunes were one we accepted as part of the road. In the evenings, after the sheep were settled and the meal cooked and eaten, the puppeteers rehearsed. They had 3 plays, and they seemed bent on perfecting all of them before we reached Blue Lake. Some nights it was merely the motions of the puppets and their dialogue, but several times they set up completely, torches, stage, and backdrops. The puppeteers dressed in the pure white drapings that signified their invisibility and went through the entire repertoire of plays. The master was a strict one, very ready with his strap, and he did not spare even his journeyman a lash or two if he thought he deserved it. A single line intoned incorrectly, one flip of a marionette's hand that was not as Master Dell dictated it, and he was amongst his cast, flaying about with the strap. Even if I had been in the mood for amusements, that would have spoiled it for me. So more often I went and sat looking out over the sheep while the others watched the performances. The minstrel, a handsome woman named Starling, was often my companion. I doubted that it was from any desire for my company. Rather, it was that we were far enough from the camp that she could sit and practice her own songs and harpings, away from the endless rehearsals and the weeping of the corrected apprentices. Perhaps it was that I was from Buck and could understand what she missed when she spoke quietly of the gulls crying and the blue sky over a sea after a storm. She was a typical Buck woman, dark-haired and dark-eyed and no taller than my shoulder. She dressed simply, blue leggings and tunic. There were holes in her ears for earrings, but she wore none, nor were there any rings on her fingers. She would sit not far from me and run her fingers over her harp strings and sing. It was good to hear a Buck accent again, and the familiar songs of the coastal duchies. Sometimes she talked to me. It was not a conversation. She spoke to herself in the night, and I just happened to be within earshot, as some men talk to a favorite dog. So it was that I knew she had been one of the minstrels in a small keep in Buck, one I'd never been to, held by a minor noble whose name I didn't even recognize. Too late to worry about visiting or knowing, the keep and the noble were no more, swept through and burned out by the red ships. Starling had survived, but without a place to rest her head or a master to sing for. So she had struck out on her own, resolved to head so far inland that she'd never again see a ship of any color. I could understand that drive. By walking away, she saved Buck for herself, as a memory of how it had been once. Death had come close enough to her to brush her with its wingtips, and she wasn't going to die as she was, a minor minstrel for a lesser noble. No, somehow she was going to make her name, was going to witness some great event and make a song about it that would be sung down the years. Then she'd be immortal, remembered as long as her song was sung. It seemed to me she would have had a better chance of witnessing such an event if she'd stayed on the coast where the war was. But as if in answer to my unspoken thought, Starling assured me that she was going to witness something that left its witnesses alive. Besides, if you've seen one battle, you've seen them all. She saw nothing especially musical about blood. To that,
I nodded mutely.
Ah, I thought you looked more like a man-at-arms than a shepherd. Sheep don't break one's nose or leave a scar like that on your face.
They do if you tumble down a cliff, looking for some in a mist, I told her dourly, and turned my face aside from her. For a long time, that was as close as I came to having a conversation with anyone. We journeyed on, moving only as fast as laden wagons and a herd of sheep would permit. The days were remarkably similar. The countryside we passed was remarkably similar. There were a few novelties. Sometimes there were other folk camped at the watering places we came to. At one, there was a tavern of sorts, and here the caravan master delivered some small kegs of brandy. Once we were followed for half a day by folk on horseback, who might have been bandits. But they veered off and left our trail in the afternoon, either bound to a destination of their own, or deciding what we possessed wasn't worth the effort of a raid. Sometimes other folk passed us, messengers and folk travelling on horseback, unslowed by sheep and wagons. Once it was a troop of guards in the Pharaoh colours, pushing their horses hard as they passed us. I felt an uneasiness as I watched them pass our caravan, as if an animal scrabbled briefly against the walls that shielded my mind. Did a skilled one ride amongst them, Burl or Carid, or even Will? I tried to persuade myself it was merely the sight of the golden brown livery that unnerved me. On another day we were intercepted by three of the nomadic folk whose grazing territory we were in. They came to us on tough little ponies that wore no more harness than a hackamore. The two grown women and the boy were all blonde with faces baked brown by the sun. The boy's face was tattooed with stripes, like a cat's. Their arrival occasioned a complete halting of the caravan, while Madge set up a table and cloth and brewed a special tea, which she served to them with candied fruit and barley sugar cakes. No coin exchanged hands that I saw, only this ceremonial hospitality. I suspected from their manner that Madge was long known to them, and that her son was being groomed to continue this passage arrangement. But most days were the same plodding routine. We rose, we ate, we walked. We stopped, we ate, we slept. One day I caught myself wondering if Molly would teach her to make candles and tend bees. What could I teach her? Poisons and strangling techniques, I thought bitterly. No. Her letters and numbers she'd learned from me. She'd still be young enough when I returned for me to teach her that, and all Burridge had ever taught me about horses and dogs. That was the day when I realized I was looking ahead again, was planning for a life after I'd found Verity and somehow taken him safely back to Buck. My baby was just an infant now, I told myself, suckling at Molly's breasts and looking about with wide eyes and seeing all new. She was too young to know something was missing, too young to know her father wasn't there. I'd be back with them soon, before she learned to say, Pa. I'd be there to see her first steps. That resolve changed something in me. I'd never looked forward to something so much. This was not an assassination that would end in someone's death. No. I looked forward to a life, and imagined teaching her things, imagined her growing up bright.